Welcome to LA Lit. Today is Sunday, May 12th, and we're here in Chinatown, LA, with the great poet Guy Bennett, who is our first ever native son of Los Angeles to be on the show today. I'm Stephanie Ryu.
And I'm Matt Timmons, and LA Lit is an internet show. You know, we record interviews with writers primarily from Los Angeles, but also we record interviews with writers who happen to be in Los Angeles for you know, other reasons. LA does pull some a certain amount of literary culture from other cities, amazingly enough. And we are hosted by Superbunker, which is at www.superbunker.com. And like Stephanie said, we're here at Beta Level in Chinatown. And you can go to their website, betalevel.com, and find out about events going on here. There are other things that happen here besides LA Lit. And you can also, this is like a list of websites, but you can also go to our website, which is la-lit.com, and you can find archives of all the interviews we've done with other writers, and there's a podcast of the show that you can subscribe to, and there's, you know, other pieces of work by the people we've had on the show, so you can find literature there, and audio recordings, and all kinds of fun stuff. So yeah, we're here with Guy Bennett. Thank you so much for agreeing to be on the show.
Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah. And
yeah, so Guy Bennett is the author of 4 collections of poetry, most recently Drive to Cluster, which came out in 2003, a collaboration with artist Ron Griffin. He is also co-author with Beatrice Moosley of Charting the Here of There, French and American Poetry in Translation in Literary Magazines, 1850 to 2002. His writing has appeared a lot of places, magazines and anthologies in Brazil, Canada, France, Italy, Mexico, Morocco, and the United States. He is also a translator. His recent translations include works by Mostafa Nisaburi, Nicole Brossard, Valère Novarina, and Jacques Roubaud. Did I say that right?
You got it.
He lives in Los Angeles, where he publishes Seeing Eye Books. Welcome.
I don't know what to say. Thanks.
And I think we're just going to start off with the Oracle 4 piece. So if you want to just jump in, and then we'll chat about it.
Okay. These are like a little sweet, it's a little suite of poems, sort of an homage to Syd Barrett, whose music we were listening to just a few minutes ago. It's called Oracle 4, 1 dozen fortune cookies for Syd Barrett. And if you want to find out what the fortune cookie thing is all about, I'll tell you in a little while. On Owsley's to view the planets, this plum shine bliss twixt orange and burnt pear is as a star map to a blind man's eye, better than candy and a currant bun, than moon splashed cubes, sugar blue wind to spatchcock the inner mind and heaven reflect. The brush you bristle and twist, your thick fur will warm you, wilt in the linen bin, step, bump, then rumble, must be the pipes, onto the fields of praise, prosatic screen. The dropper stopped, filled, one splash to soil the skin, absorbed via fingers this liquid burns of thither, the water, even air, spiked here. Many are the means of reasoned flight to those blithe countries. My eyes, simplicity called contrast, steeped in paisley stuffs and scrimlight light, spun thin and focused to clarity, I wind on. Script thought shallow twin, should crinoline caked legs spread cheer. Be my 14-hour technicolor dream houses stuttering chimney, your brittle touch quiets to whisper like theme-fluted wrinkles, slouching to bread town, breaking in all spirit splashed and spangled, its eiderdown emerald dress. The it launch you thrilled, trolling the packed roundhouse past May time and tide tell, jostling a mass, attend me now, still sloshy and gelling to a low, ominous astronomy, domine nerve net to party our ascendance up 3 iron pillars whereon you peak, totally grooved with your mouth open. Strange this lime tree bower, its grimy, very cold customs moon projections play on the skin, shine, pearl, prevail. Slip on the caterpillar hood, won't cover the head of nearer to thee, my brandish a one with a feathery tongue, future blue thistle star above you crystal holds open the red and yellow mane of a stallion, horsehair blue buggy whipped gift, a wonder wall to jump, field to cross of crimson sails cackling at every plate we break, contentment. Into light you emerge, steaming and shriveled, a damp mass, heaven sprung from air. Your voice a squeak, a cinder robed in fine gray soot and glowing burnt orange, charming things met with along the way. To sleep in the woods, to awaken eyes with open lids, lashed pupils, dilated, pulsing, bleeding, sounding words. Thick this skin you don, a brill cream robe you pour on, are you? Hair all studded with budding mandies, a floodlight welds to the spell-stopped person you were. Cracked by scattered needles, drained of rage and rain distress, you abscess into culture. Phases of you glean in patches of dark open sky, thoughts are tunes to riddle us with. Set in a minor mood ring, opalescent swirls pattern to person the blank night in your spitting image of spliff hash chunk season. Opening the eye on imaginative sight, unseen and splendorous with yet unknown airs, and green grow the rushes, honest are your aims, sincere your best of intentions. Obviously one, your was better off, work with a silver guitar, interests with mirrors and things can all over it than people capture who ended up on the floor, thee or anywhere else in London. I've always highest thought of going back to a place, status, where you can drink tea and sit on or the carpet. I've been fortunate enough to do that, prestige. Piebald thought, you hiss. My mind's own rhizome zealage may glisten with spittle pearls bead, settling soon in open copses, clearings, clutter to clusters change, organize, arrange themselves in fetching songs, your eyes turn inward, what you see. Bright lines sketch a space, find me inside of a nocturne to blonde blistered butch woodwork. Shine on, you crazy diamond, your hand to the ukulele turn, will you? Probing a rift in the skiffle boom, box soon lidless as fans wax fondly o'er tunes to be, as airs Trojan horse your vision into the charts, charm ears involved in hearing sound spill from the hole in itself. Your mind, a quality common but unknown to many, a candle to be snuffed out at any minute, gatherings engage the senses, blue wind, ice cream, excuse me, and skeleton kiss to the steel railroads lead to parties. The water you breathe, I breathe, will you, I breathe as be the water, I breathe as showered the water, streams over me, I with you breathe as the water streams over good me, with you I breathe as the water streams luck over me.
That was great. Would you be willing to read the fortune cookies that these are based on?
Ah, the little, yeah, the little fortunes.
Had to ask.
Yeah, these are the list of fortunes that are inside of those poems. The first one, to shine is better than to reflect. You will step on the soil of many countries. Simplicity and clarity should be your theme in dress. That's always been probably my favorite fortune. You may attend a party where strange customs prevail. The near future holds a gift of contentment. You have a charming way with words. You are a person of culture. You are a person of imaginative yet honest intentions. Your work interests can capture the highest status or prestige. You may soon change your line of work. I guess that's kind of ominous after the preceding one. You will soon be involved in many gatherings and parties. You will be showered with good luck.
I really like the, you're a person of imaginative yet honest intention.
That's great. Yeah.
Before we started the show, we were talking a little bit about how this piece came together. You and Mr. Barrett have a charming way with words, as a fortune said. You got that fortune and dedicated it to Sid. So when I was reading these, I heard Sid Barrett kind of singing these words in my head and in that kind of deadpan voice that he has, and realized soon your constraint here and was sort of immersed in the whole thing. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about how it all came together.
Okay. It revolved around a magazine project that a friend had founded. And it was, Diane, I believe you were involved in that as well, Logost Project. So the idea was to share with a group of some 20 poets work in progress, things that you happen to be working on. And I never happen to really be working on anything until somebody invites me to participate in something. So my thought was, what can I write toward this project? And at the time, for some reason or other, I was getting all obsessed with, you know, the London subculture of the mid-60s, LSD, psychedelic music, and all of that, and got hooked on Sid Barrett's two or three solo records. Someone who, though I've always been interested in pop music, I just had never really listened to before. And so, as I tend to always work from some sort of source material, I thought I would try to find a potential way to sort of do an homage to him. And I had all these fortunes from fortune cookies that I've eaten. I saved the fortunes. And went through the little box of fortunes and found 12 that seemed to kind of resonate with the feeling I had about his work, and decided that I would, you know, make poem cookies around the fortune, so to speak. In other words, let just the fortune thread through the poem. So the first line of each fortune is the first word of the first line of each poem. The second word in the fortune is the second word on the second line, the third word on the third line, and so forth. So there I had already a little textual sort of thread. And what I did was just wrote these poems around that thread by taking lines from either his lyrics or things that people had said about him or things related to the kind of underground scene at that time and events that took place that he was involved in and things like that, and just kind of made these things as sort of small mosaic-like poems around those fortunes. And the fortune cookie metaphor was kind of fun for me because, in a way, his music is like that. For me, at any rate, listening to some of that stuff and getting into it, there's always something really surprising in the middle of it, something that you didn't expect, some unusual something. So that seemed to be an appropriate kind of way to approach those pieces dedicated to him, as it were. So anyway, that's where they came from.
And we'll probably talk about this as we go through today talking to you, but I, you know, it's like this kind of process-based writing. I mean, there's a lot of people that try it in different manners, you know, and yet, you know, when you do it, it sounds, you know, first of all, it sounds not necessarily like process writing, and you also seem to pull it off with you have a kind of an obvious interest in the way that words are kind of like sitting next to each other, how they sound next to each other, the rhythms that you create, and I wonder if you can talk about your composition practices besides, like, you know, the just putting it together.
I mean, a lot of it is constraint-based, as we briefly talked about, like that piece was, and the others that I'll be reading. And then, I'm really enchanted and attracted by the musical side of it, the strange sounds, the rhythms and whatnot, the sort of rare words that or old words that we don't really use anymore, and I like to put them in a context with other more contemporary words so that there's a strange kind of lexical kind of clashing or noise in there. And essentially it's all like a mosaic type thing where I collect source material from a variety of places, and Diane, you were just talking about this kind of approach last time, and to sit down to write the poem, look at what you have in front of you that you've collected for the piece, and then pick and choose what you want and organize it how you want. And what's really wonderful for me about doing that is that I sort of sketch it out, and then when I go back to it, I always find myself wanting to invert words and change the orders of things so that, you know, sugar cube becomes cube sugar, or some, you know, some unusual combinations can take place. The words are already there next to one another, but when you see them there then there's this physical thing, and you might think, well, why not pick this thing up and put it to the right of the other thing and see what that creates? It allows you to kind of break down certain sorts of typical rhythms or expressions, and while retaining those words, create new kind of combinations that are a little bit unusual and hopefully snag your mind and make you want to look a little bit deeper into it to try to understand it. I love the compound noun kind of thing. I use that a lot.
Yeah, you have a great lyric intuition and keen ear, it seems to me. And I know you're involved with music, and this piece, and in fact your book, The Row, too, is in dialogue with these musicians. So
yeah.
Do you find that listening to music helps your poetry music? Or?
I don't know. Regarding The Row that you mentioned, the chapbook that was published some years ago, and then these Barrett pieces. I mean, I was listening to the music as I was doing them because I just wanted to have that in my mind as I was thinking about these pieces. But for some reason or other, I seem to have kind of drifted a little bit away from music and don't listen to as much as before. I worked as a musician for many years and was really constantly involved in and around it. And I think maybe I just got saturated and needed to kind of put it aside a little bit. So not as much as before. I just recently got an iPod as a Christmas gift. So now I wish I had had that thing 20 years ago. But I'm thinking, all right, well, let me dig out those old things and see, you know, if I'm still interested in listening to them today and whatnot. I may, you know, I got some John Cage on there. There's some Webern, you know, Brian Eno, that kind of stuff. So I'm listening a little bit more. But for a couple years, there was a real lull.
How do you think, I mean, it's interesting that, you know, we're talking about how you listen to music while you're, or at least while you're preparing the work. But I wonder also, like, I find, or at least I found, it seems like people who do a lot of translation work, which you do a lot of translation work, seem to have, like, at least to me, to my mind, like a totally different relationship with the way that they put, you know, language together, whether it's, you know, if it's in English or whatnot. But can you talk a little bit about the, you know, how your translation work affects, like, your, you know, your own writing?
Yeah, well, I mean, one thing that it affects it in a couple of ways that I'm able to talk about, and then it's definitely in harmony with it in a number of other ways. Some of the ways that it affects it is that, you know, obviously translating work from people writing in other languages, living in other countries, and having grown up in other cultures is that you're exposed to things that are different from where you are and where you come from personally. And so it allows me to kind of see how things are being done in other places, and sometimes they're quite different than here, and that allows you to at least realize that there are other ways possible to doing it than the ways people are doing it here. And you may wish to, if you feel close to it, kind of get into it a little bit more and see if you can adopt it or somehow or other activate the strategies you're uncovering as you translate in your own writing. Sometimes I find that it's kind of a successful graft. Sometimes I find that I'm starting to sound a little too much like some poets that I've translated, and so I have to sort of stop doing that or need to reconsider if I want to continue to do it. To a certain extent, it allows me to kind of be exposed to things that are different from what I would be exposed to normally here. And then I've given a lot of thought to this, to the issue of translating, spent a lot of time on it. This is also something I want to get away from because it eats up all of my time, and I spend my time translating other people's work and not doing any of my own, so I'm definitely going to be putting that aside somewhat. But I'm wondering if, or thought about the fact that I always tend to work from some sort of source text. It's very rarely me just sitting down and writing. I'm always going someplace and taking something that previously exists that I want to do something with, and I'm wondering if it's somehow or other I have that way of working in me, and that's what drives me to translating, because you're taking something that somebody's already done and you're kind of working on it and reshaping it and making it come out in your own language. Or if it's the fact that I enjoy translating, which is taking somebody else's work and doing all that to it, that's driving me to look at writing in my own language that way. Go to another previously existing text and somehow or other put it, you know, somehow or other get it and transform it and make something new out of it. I'm not sure, but I definitely feel that those two things are related in my case. And you know, I don't know exactly where they came from or why they're there, but that's how it sort of happened.
In a way, with the first two pieces you're doing for us, this one you just read and then the next one too, even working with work in English, like Syd Barrett or Walt Whitman and
An unlikely combination. Yeah.
But I mean, in a way, no, because there's kind of a romantic tradition there. And with Webern, too, there's sort of a romantic mm-hmm. tradition there. And I as I was looking through your pieces, I'm like, that's interesting. Webern's late romantic, and mm-hmm. then Walt fits in. And even Barrett could be considered, you know, in the psychedelic sense, to be like that kind of lone wolf out there. Are you attracted to that kind of stuff?
Yeah, definitely, definitely. I'm a big Wordsworth fan, a big Coleridge fan. I still very much enjoy reading some of their writings. Definitely. Why, I don't know. I guess I kind of like the... very much interested in the lyric, and I really kind of like the over-the-top emotionality of some of that romantic writing. And there's just something, I don't know, there's something that appeals to it, to me, in it. I have never really consciously thought about it, but hearing you say it, yeah, definitely. I mean, it's a field of interest for me that I kind of come back to frequently. Why? I honestly don't know. Maybe I should have psychoanalysis, try to find out.
No way.
Well, do you want to read that next piece you're going to read?
Sure, Lilac gladly. Variations? Gladly.
Oh, wait, before you start, it's mm-hmm. a good time to hear Lilac Variations because it's spring, kind of early spring, which is of concern, as we know. And there aren't too many lilacs in Los Angeles, but since Walt was born in New York, that Rochester I read is the capital, the lilac capital of the world.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so it kind of fits in with Walt and the flower and how it smells so good and the colors and everything. So I just want to bring that up to kind of set the mood for these beautiful poems to come.
Well, there are reworkings of Whitman's When Lilacs Last in the Dooryard Bloomed. Which, though I'm not necessarily a very big Whitman fan, that title has always just resonated with me for some reason or other. It's just magnificent. And so there was a conference this past summer in Paris to celebrate the 150th anniversary of the first edition of Leaves of Grass. And a couple of young people who were involved in organizing it decided they wanted to have a reading done at the same time in conjunction with the conference and sent an invitation out to American poets to contribute a text which, if they happened to be in Paris, they could come and read, or if not, somebody there would read them. And they proposed to translate these into French and to publish them in a little chapbook. And they got so many responses that they wound up doing a pretty thick anthology, bilingual, of reactions to, comments on, writing in one way or another, engaging Whitman's work. So my contribution to that was this little set of variations, which I call the Lilac Variations. And, you know, we can talk more about them in a few minutes. So there's a little dedication that says, after Whitman, in memoriam, McClough, and thinking of Hopkins. There are 16 little variations for the 16 sections of Whitman's piece. While lilac shades whitewashed silver wind-dappled dwellings with solemn dreams shining and blooming with lustrous woe, the gentle west chanted, bring forth this calm day a last fragrant world. Welcome that dooryard gaze moving many when approaching death. Glad leaves line dense stacks of fresh trees, of whispering loud cedars sea waves leave gray, growing grave brown leaves of heaven death, heavenly leaves of grass grain shall pass as gray lanes recess. O death of heaven, of death heads, heart-shaped fields, land perfumes, understand voices, ghostly verse outlet, since lilac lovely swamp cedars praise always these, our flower feastings. Whitewashed their delicate roses with lilac death, and sane in shadowy churches, I dissatisfied you, wisest deliveress, pointed love's unloosing organs, aroused all lilac shades, dropped the broken green countenance with unclosed battle flags, hurrying thus the bloody loved lilacs break approaching psalm. Pale yellow speared warbling fragrant wast where white waiting shall bloom. Wind-dappled dwellings work calm, welcome gentle lilac shining with many moving dreams that chant forth,
bringing dooryard blooming, bush-bloomed washling's white world to land lustrous this last dooryard, fronting death's silver gaze. Our chant first transparent mid dense tides of gray cities, while floods of gorgeous fresh leaves branches give to heavenly voices whispering gray-brown death to the gentle, measureless heavens, perfume cruel land-peeped cedars that harsh blossoms and great, glad, ghostly waves leave secluded in death. This one's for Federico. Lilac, I know lilac, I though lilac, thou show'st shade shadowy and sane of rose-aroused organs unloosing love, all tall-growing, rising, unapproaching, bare the unclosed bush my deliverous countenances, winding wise in lilac long-standing, you there die, dropped, broken and bloody, in death's dissatisfied debris. The bush bloom day fragrant, its lustrous silver gaze of lilac blooming dooryards and south sailing storm bent chimneys bring dooryard dreams to the whitewashed world, while solemn death chants this last western walk. What grave floods of gorgeous fresh leaves, of dense tides, land gentle, measureless, heavenly voices of ghostly gray brown verse. Praise we always whispering waves of cedar's loud swamp perfume that harsh blossoms leave secluded mid cities given branches first chant. Warble one burning leaves the distance hills. Delicious cities warble in their husky panoramas, warble masterland daily. Its soldier-shaped shores bloom, drooping, bloom, droop, delicate dooryard palings, the ever-returning trinity spots. Arousing in endless wheat, the lilac miracle, every dark brown corpse clouds, mournful. These bright workmen homeward hurrying warble the while, warble well all the dooryard day, till the death meeting distance, fragrant with dreams, with the large, lustrous dooryard blooming silver world all chanted, though solemn, this last lilac bush bringing forth woe-bloomed calm. Here against heaven's voices, ghostly death, ghostly, lovely, death-praised universes sure and winding of gray-brown gray on brown gray-brown pine leaves. Leaves leave leaves heart-shaped, heaven-meant freshness, heaven again aroused. O western stars, star recesses, breast-granted passes all draped of lilac blossoms, lily's perfume, with hands and eyes yet low. I depart the lilac fields, passing soldiers all aroused and blooming large with husky corn, the sacred panoramas of their dooryard drooping, and how they droop. And lo, the endless fields of daily bloomed lilac, the lilac bush's delicate heart-shaped leaves praise me silent while I return, warbling homeward. Warble master, hold forth with swift sea tide, solemn soothing, with chanted dreams, with dooryard blooming, just felt calm, bringing welcome death to the shining land's last western dwellings. All star aroused and paling, looked we on aerial beauty, on the star midst of dense packed heaven's prairie lands, from fields of treetops, lovely leaves, grave, gorgeous leaves, gentle branches chant, looked we with clear voices on heaven's first stars. Delicious remained these clear-bound visions of long lilies drooping, till the bleeding chant of the warble bird clang forth, all lilac, 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 and dooryard, 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 breaking the solemn gaze, secluding me in dim cities, while west the early star shines lovely upon the heart-shaped woodlands. Wailing, falling, filling with thee this last bloomed dooryard, fronting well whitewashed palings, lilac settlements, spotting solemn approaching death's welcome chant, bringing fragrant dreams.
So this is some beautiful alliterative work, and also I started counting syllables, and there's lots of seven syllable lines, which is a great number of syllables to have in a line, I think.
Yeah.
I like those seven-syllable lines. But And of course, clearly accentual syllabic too, but do you count syllables and not in accents?
In this poem, no, definitely not. But it's interesting that you sang really seven syllable lines. No,
there's
definitely
lots.
Not. In other times, counting is important, but it wasn't in these poems.
But you did use other methods to make these happen.
Yeah. Do you want me to comment on that, or?
If you want to.
Yeah, sure. Basically, the mention of McLowe at the beginning is that he had just died. These poems are about a year old. And he had just died the preceding year. And, you know, I felt that I wanted a way to get into this piece by Whitman. I didn't know what I wanted to do with it, but I knew I wanted to do something. And so I was thinking of McLowe's Dies Text method, which consists of using a source. In my case, I used three sources, the first of which was Walt Whitman. And what he would do, and what I did in this poem, was to basically follow the letters of my source as I read through the poem. So looking for the first word in the poem beginning with a W, as Walt does, and setting that word aside. And then looking for the next word that had an A in the second position, as Walt does, and then setting that word aside. And then an L in the third position, and setting that aside, and so forth and so on. I also used the title of the book, Leaves of Grass, as a second thread, and the title of the poem, When Lilacs Last of the Dooryard Bloomed, as a third thread, and then read through the poem 16 times, once for each of the 16 sections, and each time beginning with the next section. And each time came up with a little lexicon from, you know, words gleaned during each reading using the particular thread in question, and that little lexicon is what I used to write these poems. So each variation represents the gleanings of one reading using one source through the 16 sections of his poem. And you know, so this is exactly the way that I too easily work. And I've got my little material, now I just need to organize it. And I've never made a mosaic, but that's what I think this kind of composition is like, and taking the bits and pieces that you've collected and then organizing them in a pattern that is pleasing to you. So that's how these things came to be. You know, and then the Hopkins reference, once again, is just for all the music of it, you know. Uh-huh. And that's pretty much how that happened.
Can you talk a little bit about, like, I'm sure you've read a whole bunch of Whitman, and I have as well, and we were talking about Whitman before we started recording the show, but tell us a little bit about, like, your, I don't know, how you've reacted to Whitman in the past, besides just with this piece, or?
Very little, to be perfectly honest. I don't know his work very well. I mean, I know who he is, and I know his sort of stature and what he represents, not only for American poetry, but also for so many other poetries. He's a very, very important name in the very beginnings of modern poetry in a lot of different places. He is and has always been hugely popular in France. There's just been a brand new translation of the entire Leaves of Grass, and it is not the only one. There are many, many of them available. And I was in Morocco for a poetry festival in 2004 and had many North African poets telling me about Walt Whitman and how important Walt Whitman was to them. I mean, he's, you know, all that said, I never read him. You know, I've attempted to get into Leaves of Grass, but I never was sufficiently intrigued by it to really want to plow through the whole, to want to mow that lawn. So I haven't. But this invitation was an opportunity for me to go and get into it. And what was very interesting is that I never really realized what this poem was about. It's all about Lincoln's death and the funeral, how do we call it? The procession is going through the town. He frequently talks about the coffin with this great man as being borne in this coffin through the town and so forth. And it never really dawned on me. And it was very funny afterwards thinking about it, you know, that the poem was in a way also thinking of McLowe's recent passing and whatnot, and it also happened to kind of coincidentally be about death. And so there was a lot of interesting ways in which this kind of came together. But he, you know, I have to say, he's just never been a poet that I've kind of really connected with.
Well, it's interesting because Stephanie and I were talking about this earlier about you're doing a kind of reading of Whitman in the way that you said, like doing these kind of process that basically gives us like a kind of slanted reading of Whitman.
Mm-hmm.
But somehow, and somehow through that process, you know, there's a certain amount of eroticism that comes through with Whitman in here, And of course, the kind of like, you know, themes of death, where it seems almost like a, you know, almost like a daydream, almost like, you know, a corpse's dream or something, or it's kind of dusky dream sense.
Yeah.
And what was, to me, what I was thinking about, and I don't know if you can comment on this or not, but I mean, whether, you know, this is controlled by, this, the writing is controlled by a process or whatever, there is, it's like there is a shift that you make. And I've read Whitman a bunch, but you know, his eroticism and his kind of meditations upon death, I feel like you get something that's kind of shifted a little bit more, as if, you know, with a slight influence of like Bataille or something like that, you know, but maybe that's probably just my reading, one reader's reaction, but can you talk about kind of the way you dealt with some of the themes that were handed to you by Whitman, but
sure.
That you were...
Sure. I mean, in a way, doing something like this is like working anagrams, you know, and one of the amusing things about anagrams is that, which, you know, it's just like taking a line and making a different permutation of all the letters in the line to get different words and, you know, an anagram. And one of the interesting things about the anagram is, on the one hand, you can only work with the letters that are there. So you can't willfully just bring whatever you want into it. You have to just deal with what's there. On the other hand, you're the one who's selecting the new combinations of the letters and the new words of the letters that you put together in your anagrammatic reworking of the original line. So what I mean to say by this is, on the one hand, everything that you're going to get out of it is already in it. But on the other hand, you're the one who's going to go in there looking for and finding the new things. So to a certain extent, it's a reflection of the original writer, but to another extent, it's a reflection of you. Because our anagrams of the same line are not necessarily going to be the same thing. So working on a piece like this, it's the same exact sort of situation, where I didn't add or change a single word of anything that I took. I used them as I found them in his work. I allowed myself to reorganize them and recombine them, and inevitably they're saying the same old thing, but maybe in a different way. And that poem being about death, it's inevitable that it comes into here. Obviously, aware of Whitman's sexuality, I couldn't help but allow myself certain references to it in here when the words were there. Like, yeah. Well, there's one in here that nobody laughed as I read this, although I thought parts of it are very funny. But there's a couple in here that really make me snicker. There's one in here, that's the 12th one. I depart the lilac fields, passing soldiers all aroused and blooming large with husky corn. There was nary a snicker in the room as I read that line. And then the sacred panoramas of their dooryard drooping, and how they droop.
Yeah.
And lo, L-O, but it's, and I mean, so these sorts of things. When you're getting those kind of words given to you, how could you not say something like that? Or, you know, I mean, I wanted to kind of bring that in as well. So those kind of things inevitably come in because they're in your mind and you're thinking about it. But you're bringing up something here that I think I would like to mention about the uses of constraints and processes and so forth, is I really admire those people. And Cage was one, and I think McLowe was one, but to what extent he was one, I can't say for sure. But those people who really are the hardcore users of constraint and process, who really, they set the machine in motion and whatever comes out, Cage was particularly this way, that's what your piece is. You don't tinker, you don't, whatever you put it in one end and whatever comes out, that's it. I always want to tinker. I don't want to leave it the way that it is. I always want to get in and change it a little and polish it here, or rough it up there. Or, you know, I can't leave it alone. Because I guess that's not interesting enough to me. I want to be able to get in and make it do something. And maybe that's where that other side that you're referring to is kind of coming in. I admire the ones that can just let it come out and then that's it. Because I think you get a lot less unexpected, or you get a lot more unexpected, and you get a lot less intentionally controlled things. And that's what Cage was all about. But in the end, I guess I just can't let it go. I want to get in and fiddle with it.
Yeah, I mean, this is something I'm interested in, of course, and there's... I was just thinking about this while you were sitting and reading and while we're talking about it, but, you know, I mean, poets, you come from a tradition of highly metered and, you know, like, thinking about the, you know, stresses and counting syllables or, you know, that kind of a world, whether we take that as our own kind of literary heritage or not. And yet, you know, the kind of the kind of literary heritage that I look back on in a kind of more recent past, there's a lot of people who are doing something similar, like these types of processes, mm-hmm. which are not applied in quite the same way as, like, you know, thinking about stresses in a line and all that. It's a different type of process. Mm-hmm. And I wonder, I mean, I don't know, this is something I think about, but I wonder what these types of process writings, like, what that reflects upon, or what kind of, you know, what kind of aesthetic choice it is to write in this manner. And I wonder if you can talk about that, which I think you kind of already have, but uh-huh. you know.
I'm not really sure what it reflects. I mean, I know for me, as we were talking about earlier, I never really start out with something that I feel I need to express in a mm-hmm. poem. Mm-hmm. I mean, if I had some urgent message, I would pick up the phone and call you and tell you. I wouldn't write a poem and hope that one day you might see it in a magazine or something. I mean, so for me, it's all about working with what's there, or find. I mean, you know, when you hear something that somebody's music that somebody's made, or a poem that somebody's written, thinking, boy, I wish I had done that. You know, how maybe I could take it and do something with it. You know, or maybe I could figure out what that person did that's so intriguing to me, and maybe I could do something with that. And so I guess in my personal case, what it reflects on is just my way of working, which is always, once again, wanting to start from something that's there and work with some concrete thing, yeah. as opposed to wanting to communicate something particular that I know about ahead of time. Because inevitably, everything communicates. You can't avoid it. But it's not something that I've predetermined. So this just kind of, for me, is my MO, I mean, for whatever reason.
But ideas do come from it. I mean, like I said, yeah. I mean, I'm jealous. Because, I mean, I have strong feelings towards sound and alliteration and all that stuff. But then when it comes to the ideas, I start, you know, with a blank mind. So, and as I've been reading your work, I've been like, shoot, I wish I could do that.
See, there's the thing. What could I do with it?
Yeah, this is how it all I know. Becomes, now that you said that, I might employ that. But many ideas do come, so.
Yeah. Well, I'm teaching a class on Cage currently, so he keeps coming to mind. But he has that, you know, in that lecture on nothing, there's the beautiful line. He's giving this lecture, and he says, you know, if an idea should happen to, he says something like, I don't have any idea, but if an idea should happen to come up in this discussion, let it, you know? Mm-hmm. And I mean, there is an idea from the point of departure, just like with these poems, but the idea is to set the machine in motion. Mm-hmm. And inevitably, something will come out of the other end, and that's going to mean something, just because language is a meaning-bearing, you know, material. And so it's always going to mean something.
Yeah. Well, why don't we take a break, and then we'll be back. Let's take just a 10, 15-minute break.
Very good.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah, thank you.